On the evening of November 1st, 2023, in the Hager Auditorium of the Museum of the Rockies, the Ivan Doig Center for the Study of the Lands and Peoples of the North American West hosted a conversation between historians Betsy Gaines Quammen and Liesl Carr Childers, addressing issues raised in Dr. Quammen's second book, True West, Myth and Mending on the Far Side of America. Her earlier book is American Zion, Cliven Bundy, God and Public Lands in the West. Janet Orr, director of the Ivan Doig Center, began the program introducing the Wallace Stegner Chair of Western American Studies, Mark Fiji.
I would like to welcome the Wallace Stegner Chair of Western American Studies, Mark Fiji, who is knowledgeable. He's our expert on the American West. And so he is going to introduce our speakers tonight, who are going to be talking about the myths, misperceptions, and cultural conflicts that trouble the West today in celebration of Dr. Quammen's new book, True West, The Myth and Mending on the Far Side of America. So, Mark.
It's an honor for me to introduce tonight's speakers. I would add that both of whom are not only outstanding scholars, but they are outstanding writers. They write beautifully, and this upholds the traditions of Ivan Doig and Wallace Stegner and their associations with Montana. Events such as this are one of the hallmarks of Montana State University, which plays an outsized role in the intellectual and public life of the state and the American West generally. There are other public universities in the West with far greater wealth and prestige, but Montana State University equals or excels them in its appetite for great books, speakers, and fresh ideas. Author and historian Betsy Gaines Quammen earned a doctorate from Montana State University in 2017. Her dissertation, which she completed under the direction of my colleague Dr. Michael Reedy, became the basis of her first book, American Zion, Cliven Bundy, God, and Public Lands in the West, published in 2020. That book brought critical acclaim and established Dr. Quammen as a leading authority on reactionary politics and Western public lands. She and her work have been featured in the New York Times, the New York Daily News, History News Network, and TEDx. Her latest book, True West, Myth and Mending on the Far Side of America, published this year, and the focus of tonight's event, speaks to the sources of political reaction and division in the West and their potential resolution. Betsy Gaines Quammen, the editor and critic Jen Hillebrandt has written, has an uncanny ability to boldly cross any divide, literal or metaphorical, with grace and an intention to learn and understand. Liesl Carr Childers, Dr. Quammen's interlocutor this evening, is an associate professor of history at Colorado State University, Fort Collins, where she researches, writes, and teaches about the American West, the public lands, and the environment. She is affiliated with the Public Lands History Center at Colorado State, and she and her work have been featured on National Public Radio, PBS, and High Country News. She is the author of The Size of the Risk, Histories of Multiple Use in the Great Basin, which won the 2016 Spur Award for Contemporary Nonfiction from the Western Writers of America, and which established her as an authority on political reaction and conflict over Western public lands. Without a doubt, one of the greatest challenges in the American West today is to understand and address the region's deep political and cultural divides that cut across lines of locality, social class, occupation, ethnicity, indigeneity, colonialism, political party, and governance. Please join me in welcoming Betsy and Liesl to Montana State University.
Thanks for coming out tonight. When Betsy asked me to do this with her, I thought it was a fabulous idea because a lot of times when you write a book and you give a book talk, you're just alone on a stage trying to make sense out of your own work. And it helps if you have someone who can talk to you about your work who gets it. And I get Betsy's book. So I'm going to guide you through some things that I observed in her book that resonate both with me as a scholar and also with you probably as an audience, because I think between the two of us, we kind of know what you're thinking sometimes when you encounter difficult conversations and ideas that feel so foreign to what you're used to thinking. And for full disclosure, Betsy and I had a little conversation ahead of time. I come from a very conservative background. I was raised in a very conservative household, so I think I spend a lot of time puzzling out how to talk to my parents, and you have some advice for us on this. In Betsy's opening section, her introduction, she writes, "The West as a museum of Western myth. The West is a museum of Western myth." And my brain deconstructed that as a museum of national misperception. And I have two questions. First question we'll start with is the museum concept. Where did that come from and how did you arrive at that? And then we'll move into the myth part.
First of all, I want to thank you. I have to tell you that I came across Liesl's work during COVID, and we were asked to speak on a panel remotely. And so I loved the way she looked at the West from a point of empathy. And she was really inspirational to me because I feel like I could get pretty crabby about public land use. And she really helped me look at the human side. I was looking at it as a conservationist, and she really helped me become more empathetic. And I was really drawn to her. So the fact that we're up here tonight is, I mean, it's so great. And I'm so delighted. So I want to say, like, yay, I'm totally fangirling. So thank you big time. And I also want to answer your question in different ways. I think that there are about three ways that I would answer this. Number one, the idea of museums has a really important position or role in my own background. I grew up doing taxidermy at the Cincinnati Natural History Museum. So I took birds that had crashed into windows, and I actually stuffed them and sewed them up. And I had a huge relationship with museums and also zoos. And one of the places that I spent an enormous part of my childhood, and my sister's here tonight, she and I grew up from a very young age working at the Cincinnati Zoo. And one of the places that we spent time is in the mausoleum for Martha the passenger pigeon, who, you know, it wasn't Martha. Martha was stuffed and in the Smithsonian, but there was another passenger pigeon that was stuffed there. I think that being in that mausoleum and sort of understanding what museums could represent, I learned about extinction in that place. And Martha, or passenger pigeons, went extinct, I believe, in the 1920s. And so to me, museums could really allow for these deep and penetrating lessons. That said, I also understand that museums are incredibly fraught, and we know that there were museums that were looting, that were keeping indigenous sacred items, that the idea of museums are really complicated, and I think that as historians, that's really important to acknowledge. So when I thought about museums, number one, I thought about it from my own perspective and how I understood museums. Number two, this was a dialogue that David, my husband and I, David Quammen, who's in the audience, were talking about the idea that we as humans do have myths. They do inform the way we see things. But what happens when we have toxic myths? And so I started to think about, particularly during COVID and during increased polarization, how we were living among toxic myths in the West, which is the third answer to your question. I think that the West, for a variety of different reasons for the last 3 years, has been a place where people have looked. I mean, we know as Westerners who've lived here, we live among myths. But there were people who were looking at various ideas of the West, whether it was through the show Yellowstone, that soapy, kitschy, Kevin Costner having a ranch, you know, wide open spaces. People were sitting, they were sheltering in place, and they were looking at the West as an escape, as a place to start afresh, to be ranchy, to have this sort of a wilderness experience. I mean, there were other people who were saying, oh, the West, hale and hearty, salubrious, let's go out there. Meanwhile, our clinics in small towns were being absolutely inundated. We weren't able to take care of people with COVID. And then the other layer, and I talk about this in the Idaho Panhandle, there were people who were militia, kind of the patriots, the Christian nationalists, who were looking at the West as homeland, as frontier, as front line. And so they were informed by these notions, these myths, cowboys, rugged individuals, uber freedom, libertarianism, all these things. And they were coming out West. So when I started writing the book, I really was looking at what is happening here and how are people informed? What are they taking? What are they recognizing? How are they seeing this place and what's behind it?
So you have multiple myths that you're unpacking in this museum. And treating the West as a museum, I think, allows people to enter into that complexity because no one goes to a museum thinking that it's absolutely perfect. But in public history, we know that in a 1998 survey that Roy Rosenzweig and David Thalen did on how people receive information about the past, most Americans receive information about the past or are most comfortable receiving information about the past from museums. And the West itself, you're suggesting, is this museum that we've packed in a bunch of myths, and you've explicated a lot of them, like the myth of discovery, of white settlers discovering the West. Brian Dippy wrote about the vanishing American, the myth of the disappearing Indian. Sarah Dant wrote about the myth of the West as Eden. There's so many other myths in here. Can you tell us a little bit about how you chose the myths that you then begin to explicate in the book?
I talk about the doctrine of discovery, and that's the papal bull in 1493, where it was determined by a pope that Christians that discover lands inhabited by non-Christians can take them. So we have this notion that the West was discovered. And I think that there's been the reiteration of that the people think when they come out here, the wide open spaces and the mountains and these public lands, that they're discovering them. I think that still informs people very much. And so I thought about that. I thought about the Eden myth and the agrarian myth, that the rain follows the plow, how that we still think of the West as being a place of endless resources. And I think we're really coming up against that now as we see the West on the front lines of climate change. And we're having the fires, we're having the droughts, and yet it still informs people. I see the West as being this place as people think that we have unlimited freedom, that somehow we're more free than other parts of the country. And I think that that can be traced back to the ideas of manifest destiny. This is a place that you go and you invent yourself, you put down stakes. Again, that does go to these ideas of discovery. I mean, this land, as we know, is indigenous land. But yet there's this idea that it's empty land, it's free land. And so these kind of layer on top of each other, that these notions, for as false as they are, still resonate with people. They still inform people. I do talk about Hemingway's West. I talked about masculinity and this whole idea of being in the West and proving oneself, like a proving ground. And Hemingway committed suicide in the Western states. And I'm afraid Montana has the highest, I think just most recently, it has the highest suicide rate in the country. So there are these ideas that are brought here that are not true, and yet they really inform the way people perceive this place. I talk about the American dream. I talk about the big bad wolf. I talk about this idea of the West as a sanctuary, and I talk about it as wilderness retreats and for the wealthy, whereas the people who are coming to build quote-unquote wilderness retreats are completely punching into wilderness, which we know is a myth as well, but let's say viable ecosystems that continue to erode that the ecological integrity. So it's just myth after myth after myth after myth.
I find that astounding because I'm reading the overlay of these myths, and I've never seen them in one place. So I'm, as a Western historian, right, trained at University of Nevada, Las Vegas by a man named David Rebell, who's like the dean of Western historiography. There's a long lineage of knowing your predecessors in our discipline. Never heard it all in one place. So you bring it together in a phenomenal way. But the journey you take us on is not a traditional journey. And what I mean by that is historians are really good at using those old historians, using those old works. So I fully expected you to unpack Martin Ridge or Ray Allen Billington or even some David Rebell, like the old white guys. You didn't do that. This is a good thing. This is the magic of this book. You take us on a journey in the now. You're in the middle of COVID and you're sorting this book out and you're talking to people. So the real meat of this book and the astounding thing to me, because I have a hard time doing interviews. I do them, but it's not a customary thing. Historians like they like the people they talk about to be dead because then they don't talk back. It's kind of a running joke. We like dusty archives, but you're talking to living, breathing human beings. And the interviews you do are quite frankly astounding. And all in one place, coupled with these myths, makes this book incredibly useful. But let's pause for a minute and talk about these interviews. How did you get them? How did you set them up? Because these are not with the typical interviewees. These are people who are actually hard to interview. You had a little practice with Cliven Bundy.
Oh my gosh, how did I do it? I love people. My husband jokes about it with me. He's like, you love everybody unless you don't. And so so I do draw the line at white Christian nationalists, neo-Nazis. There were bad guys in this book. I mean, absolutely bad guys. And I think it's really important to say, not going to give those guys ink. But I was really lucky because I was introduced. There's a wonderful woman who, she's a photographer, Alexis Bodanovsky, and she is a woman. She raises lambs east of Billings, and she grew up there, and her family is both from North Dakota and eastern Montana. I told her what I was thinking about doing, and she said, I'll introduce you to some people if you're nice to them. And I said, oh my God, I'm not that person. She's funny because she has kind of this campaign, and she does seminars, which, and the whole idea is don't be an asshole. That's her kind of credo. When you go into a place, just don't be. And so I promise I wouldn't. And I ended up, first of all, meeting a farmer who was a retired railroad worker in Glendive. And then he introduced me to all of his friends. I loved this guy. I mean, he was so funny. And I got to spend time with his family. And he introduced me to his friends. And then his friends introduced me to their friends. And then I put something up on Twitter. So I met all these people in eastern Montana, which I loved. And I spent tons of times there. And my dad now has gone out. He's in the audience too. He's gone out now with me to visit friends in Terry. And that's been great. But then I put out something on Twitter and just said, I'm interested in stories about extremism and polarization and how it's playing out in your particular area. And I had all these people from North Idaho get a hold of me. So I went to North Idaho and interviewed people. And then I had friends of friends introduce me to people in Escalante, and then they introduced me to the mayor, and then the mayor, I met the hardware store owner, and then they introduced me to the militia who said they weren't militia. So I met the militia that weren't militia. And so every place I went, I was just, introduce me to whoever, I'll talk to whoever. And I ended up meeting with really extraordinary people. And there were conversations that were difficult. I mean, there were conversations that we had to navigate through, both of us, not just, you know, because I was not pretending I wasn't who I was. I'm a liberal, I'm opinionated. We talked today about objectivity. I'm not real objective, but I try to be fair. And I think that came across, I hope.
I think it did, because it's pretty clear in your book that the point of the conversations wasn't about agreement. It was about dialogue. So you entered into this wanting to just have a conversation and not having very many expectations about the outcome of that conversation other than that you would have this dialogue. Can you talk a little bit about some of the more interesting people you, or perhaps difficult people you talk to? I'm thinking about the conversation with Tasha Adams. This was a difficult moment, but not in the way that you think.
One of the things that I do in this book, because this is kind of a companion piece to American Zion, which is my first book, which I did about Latter-day Saint settlement in the Great Basin and the Bundy family. And I kind of trace early church theology to the Bundy family. And they are a family in southern Nevada who have been up against the government they have cows that have been in trespass for over 20 years. They owe over $1 million in grazing fees. They don't believe the government owns land. They were engaged in an armed standoff in 2014. In 2015, I went and spent time with the family. And then in 2016, two of the sons of the Bundy family took over the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. And it was a 5-week takeover. And so this was something that involved some of the people that I wrote about in this. I do write about the Bundys in this next book, True West. But one of the characters that I spend time writing about is a man named Stuart Rhodes, who is currently spending 18 years in prison for his role in the January 6th insurrection. And he is a co-founder of the Oath Keepers, which is a national militia group, which along with the Proud Boys were two of the most prominent militia groups involved in the insurrection, and he was one of the architects. He was also involved in the 2014 Battle of Bunkerville, which was the Bundy standoff. And so I talk about his history, how in advance of the election in 2020, he was really networking with people that he had not historically networked with, mainly the medical freedom and the anti-vax people. And Ammon Bundy was very much involved in networking with the medical freedom people. And I talked to him, Ammon, in 2020, and really ask, is this going to be your next Malheur, which was the wildlife takeover in Oregon? Is this campaign going to be your next big campaign? And lo and behold, it really was. He created a militia network called People's Rights Network. They claim to have 50,000 members and really grew their numbers through people being angry about restrictions imposed to keep people safe from COVID. So at this time when this was all happening, Tasha is Stuart Rhodes' ex-wife, and she co-founded the Oath Keepers with Stuart. And she and I started to become friendly in social media, and she was in the midst of a divorce. And I sent her money on GoFundMe, which is another, like, I'm not objective. I sent her money to so she can divorce her husband. So, yeah, that's so much for objectivity here. But in any case, she and I got to be friends, and I went and visited her. She's living in Eureka, and really told me about her history. She had been a young LDS, member of the LDS community. She'd met Stuart Rhodes. He was older than her. He was impressive to her. He'd been a vet. He came from a Hispanic family. He went to Yale. He was a law student at Yale. And she had so much faith in what he could become. And he impressed her that he would become this big, strong. I mean, he was really, I talk about a myth, American dream. And so I talk about them being swept up in the American dream, you know, Yale law student, lawyer. Meanwhile, she was stripping to pay their bills. He asked her to. She started to have babies. They were going to she called it the Mormon Pantry. It's an LDS service where they feed families as part of the outreach that they did, the Relief Society. It's part of that arm. She was getting apples and oatmeal to you know, feed her kids. Stuart was not succeeding as a lawyer. And one night they sat down together and decided to create the Oath Keepers. And overnight they, I think, made $70,000 in people signing up overnight. And so she thought, oh my God, finally we can pay the bills. He let her pay the electricity bill, and then he took off to recruit and raise money. And he became increasingly abusive. He was emotionally abusive. She was very, very open about what happened and about the struggle that abused women have in deciding how they leave that person. It's incredibly difficult. And she had a miscarriage, and then she had a stillborn. And when she had a stillborn, he went to Bunkerville. And that's when she shut completely down and really started to scheme. I mean, she shut down emotionally. She really withdrew from the marriage and started to put together a plan to leave the marriage completely. I'm so glad I got to meet her. One of the things that she talks about, again, it's a myth that I thought was really interesting, that their family used to talk about. They were migrant fruit pickers. He came from a migrant fruit picker. And again, I really tried to look at so many facets of the West, and to know that Stuart Rhodes came from that was really interesting to me. And they had an expression in their family, after the grapes. Things will get better after the grapes. When we pick the grapes and the money comes in and we can have the feast and we can have peace as a family, we can relax. And so this was always something that they talked about. That was his motivation. And the fact that now his idea of the American dream so curdled. He's in prison for 18 years. She's now at community college, and it's sort of hers is hopeful. You know, she's left him. She's at community college. She's writing a memoir. Today she texted me and she said, okay, should I sign up for fiction? Or should I sign up for nonfiction? Because I want to write a memoir, but I'm thinking like storytelling might be helpful, but it is nonfiction. And I said, oh, okay, you got to do creative nonfiction, because memoir gives you a little more space to write. And I'll recommend all these memoirs. And then she said, well, I'm reading Judy Blunt right now, the memoir about a woman in an abusive marriage who's from Montana. So hers is hopeful, you know? I mean, it's really interesting to see that. But Tasha Adams, I adore her. And she's complicated.
The lesson in Tasha Adams' story is really about how the people that we hear about in the news, Stuart Rhodes, his wife, even Cliven Bundy and the Bundy brothers, we don't know these people. And your interviews help reveal a little bit more about who they really are. And underneath a lot of their conversation, you don't explicitly talk about this, but you suggest it, is this idea of material concern. Every single one of the people you talk to has some sort of concern that motivates them. There's an issue, a problem, something they care about, something they can't fix that's broken. And they're looking to solve that material concern. With that idea in mind, is there another individual that you spoke to where that sort of surfaced and you can unpack some of that material concern?
Lance. Oh, my gosh. Oh, everybody likes him. Okay. I met him in Glendive at a coffee shop, and this was a rancher who was unbelievably angry. I mean, he was angry over politics. He was angry over regulations on public land. He had a public land allotment. He was angry at environmentalists, very. He was angry over sage-grouse policy. And he said to me, I've been radicalized. I've never heard somebody just say that. Like, oh, okay. I mean, I was really taken aback. I actually couldn't quite collect my thoughts for a minute. And he was continuing to talk. He said he'd joined the NRA. He was buying guns. And I had spent so much time looking at the Bundys, looking at the militia movement, looking at the motivations there. And I knew that people were becoming increasingly radicalized because of a lot of it is manufactured. It's intentional. There were people out there wanting to radicalize people. Anyway, I write about that in the book. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to people who said that, even though I'd never had somebody actually say that. And so he was talking to me, and then he finally said, are you going to take down my information? And I realized I'd been wool gathering. I said, what do you mean? And he said, I want you to come to my ranch. And I thought, oh gosh. But I thought, no, this is what you're doing. This is why you're writing this book. And I took down his information, and I went and visited him and spent 2 days with him on his ranch. And I think I've visited him now 3 times. And he and I got along so well. He's really funny. He said, you know, if you and I ran things, we could really get things done, which is hilarious because we could not be more politically divergent. But what it showed me is that being in conversation really allows people to find common ground. Like if you're in conversation and you're finding places of agreement, you want to, and I'm not trying to be Pollyanna about it. I know that these kind of things have limitations, but I do feel like if you can get into conversation with people, you find ways to move forward in finding commonalities. I talked to him about Black Lives Matter. I talked to him about abortion. I talked to him about gun rights. He does not like seeing open carry. Like that really bugs him. I would not have thought that about him, but unless I was in conversation, I couldn't have found out those nuances. And since then, and this is something that I actually a little bit excited about, because I think that this book is going to have edges for everybody. It really calls for everybody to be self-reflective. But he read the book, and I wanted people like Lance to be able to read the book and not feel alienated and to feel like, you know what, I have political differences, but I respect who you are, and I really like you. And he just wrote me the other day. He's so cute. Do you know about Reframing Rural? Do you all know that podcast, Reframing the Rural? Anyway, it's right here in town. I might be getting the title wrong. And it's a really cool podcast. He said, I think you should know about it. You should get a book too. I think Megan is the name of the woman who operates. Sorry? Hi. Oh my gosh. Hi. Oh God. I'm so glad you're here. Okay. So Lance was the one who said, you've got to get a hold of her. And I wrote him back. I said, thank you so much, Lance. I'm so excited. I'm going to drop off a book. How are you doing? And he just said, I'm still recovering from your book. and I was like, yay, oh my God, you read it. And so, and you are so good at this too. I mean, this dialogue is so important, and your podcast is so phenomenal. And it's that kind of thing that I think it does give me hope. So he does feel like he's trying to make a living on public lands that have increasing restrictions. One of the things that he was terribly upset about is Brazilian beef. And he was saying, why can Biden cancel the Keystone Pipeline, but he doesn't do anything about regulating Brazilian beef. And I thought it was a really interesting thing. And I ended up having a conversation with a meat broker here about why don't we know we're sourcing our meat? And apparently it's a lobby that has prevented us from understanding where meat is imported, where there's local meat. And it's something that I think ranchers in this area would love to be able to tell customers, this is sourced from Montana, but they haven't been able to. And so that was something that he had, I think, very legitimate concerns. Now, he was upset about the Keystone Pipeline being canceled too. He felt like there would be revenue that would go to his school. And I've talked to people in and around the area that really were against the Keystone Pipeline, and there were conjecture. I mean, there were people who said, oh, we'd make a lot of money. And then there were people who said, no, I think it was really unclear how much money actually would be made and how many jobs would be made with the Keystone Pipeline. To be in conversation with him and to be talking about these things, the Brazilian beef thing was, I thought, was really interesting because I do think that that could help local food providers.
So this idea of material concern has undergirded a lot of my own work, because I think that what your book is pointing out and what I've tried to endeavor in my own scholarship is to push back against common assumptions, against what we think we know, and listen with a better set of ears. We only get to publish small things, though, and your book is only so many pages. So if we talk a little bit about the writing process, there's more that could have gone in this book, more work that you did than actually appears, and you had to you went through a decision-making process about what to include and what not to include. It's a painful process. For those of you who haven't published anything, it's like killing your children. It's horrible. I have a file that I put all the things that I have to let go of in, so they're not dead. They're just sort of over here because I don't want to kill my babies. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I have a gigantic Word document called Bits and Pieces of all the things I cut. And I had a section on Burning Man, which didn't make it in there. But I was talking about the mythology that went into that. I have a section on how self-indulgent and ponderous I find fly fishing literature. And I'm so sorry. I apologize for that. I really do. I did cut that. Those were the two big things that I cut. I whittled a lot of stuff down. I mean, you just have to. And it is killing your darlings. I mean, it is really hard. Writing's hard. This is something that Dave and I talk about all the time. I'll come downstairs and he's making coffee. Like, yeah, writing is hard, David. And oh, you don't say. It's lonely. It's frustrating. You're looking at the screen. My dad and David have read, and Rebecca, my friend who's also read the book, I love having people read. I will read something that I've written the day before and think, oh my God, this is horrible. I mean, it's just dreadful. There's so much editing, shaping, and conversation, feedback. I've got so many cooks in my kitchen. And I don't take all the advice. All the chapters that I have in this book, I had the main characters read it so that they could get back to me and tell me where I'd gone wrong or messed up, because I wanted it so much to reflect their truth. And I felt a real responsibility to that. But I love constructive criticism.
So this is the lesson I'm taking away. There's a methodology that Betsy's offering here that I think is worth all our consideration. For me particularly, it is letting go of the work a little sooner and maybe having people read it. That's something that more of us should do as scholars, is especially when you're dealing with actual people who have actual feelings. I may have learned a lesson very recently about what happens when you don't include people in these conversations. We don't have ethics or protocols that force us to do it except in certain circumstances, because a lot of the information is public, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't run it by the people you're writing about. So I think your bravery in that area, we don't teach our students to do this quite so much as we should, serves as an excellent model going forward. What's also a model is the way in which she approaches people just in general and people that she disagrees with. So if you read her book, and you should, there's chapter by chapter, interaction by interaction, she walks you through not just the myths, but the way they're embedded in people's lives. And she actually talks to people about their ideas and their feelings and their thoughts. And that protocol is, again, not something that we're so good at teaching our students, because as historians, we like them dead and gone and in dusty archives, but we need to get better at dealing with the living. Can you talk a little bit about something joyful and something hard in the writing process / the interview process, speaking of this method?
Well, I have to say, meeting Lance, it really was so, so tremendously joyful. One of the hard conversations I had was with the accountant in Escalante, and he is part of the Escalante Guard. And when I was in the town of Escalante, which I love, Escalante, Utah, the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, I mean, it's an absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous place. And it's a controversial national monument. There are people in that community that love it, and there are people in that community that don't love it. And it's an ongoing controversy. Clinton in 1996 established the boundaries. Trump reduced the boundaries. The boundaries were restored by Biden. And so it's been back and forth. And so some of the dialogue I had around, a conversation I had around the monument was hard. And I talked to this accountant who was part of the Escalante Guard, which I had been told was a militia. And then he told me wasn't a militia. And we had a really hard talk. We talked for 3 hours. So I want to say that the people that I talked to were enormously generous. I mean, the fact that they would talk to me about, because we were talking about public land grazing, and he had a very different opinion about public land grazing than I had. We talked about the Bundys. He had a very different opinion about the Bundys than I had. We talked about Black Lives Matter. Again, he started this militia with a couple of other people in the community because he was certain that Antifa were coming to his town. And I would talk about Antifa, that where did you get that impression? That was proliferating over social media. We had a civil, but I had knots in my stomach the whole time because I was talking to somebody who saw the world so enormously differently than I did. And at the end of it, and I do not know where this came from, he started reciting poetry. It was such an icebreaker, but like an icebreaker after 3 hours. And so he was reciting poetry about Pocketville, which I happen to know about because it was the name of Virgin, Utah, before it became Virgin, Utah. So if you all know the area by Zion National Park, it's Virgin, and then it's Springdale. And, you know, you wind through this beautiful canyon country. But Pocketville was the original name of the little town. And his wife was from there. And he started telling a poem about Pocketville. And I said, oh, my God, that's Virgin. And he couldn't believe that I knew that that was. In any case, it was just this little moment of humanity. Like, it was a tense conversation. It was not easy. And yet we had this little breakthrough. And I know that seems small, but one of the things that I was thinking about, because I was working through places that were intent on civil war. I mean, I was looking at places, building homeland in North Idaho. I mean, these guys are ready for civil war. They really are. And so I was so worried at points about the idea of othering, like othering in ways that allow hate. And for us not to be thinking about it, it's, we really do. And so one of the reasons why I was so interested in rural communities and dialogue in rural communities is because they're vulnerable to bad guys, because they have had gripes with the government, because there are issues that are legitimate. Sometimes it's appealing to throw your lot in with guys who are angry and have guns. And so I really was looking for breakthroughs in rural communities. And this was a breakthrough. It was like, we both can laugh, and we're both, you know, we're not at each other. And we do have different ways of seeing things, but we've gotten so polarized. And so I don't want to be Pollyanna, but I feel absolutely 100% certain that these conversations are imperative. And rural people, and it's funny, I mean, being from Bozeman, they don't like us. We are not real popular. Just going in and like hanging out with them, that's fine to joke about. And but it's honestly, there are a lot of Bozemanites that don't even realize that there are places beyond Bozeman. And so it's really imperative. And I was talking about this with my friend Ann Helena, who was the head of the Montana Human Rights Network. And she's since moved to Albuquerque. And she said, wouldn't it be great if college students, instead of spending a year abroad in Europe, went and spent time in a rural community? And I know that there are VISTA programs. I know there are opportunities for that. But I would love to see more interactions, because we are in a polarized place. And I do think the West has the opportunity. And again, we were talking about this earlier. I think that we can be a place of reconciliation. I think that we still have so much common ground. I think we love some of the same things. And again, I don't want to be kumbaya. I know that I can be. But I do believe it's possible.
And I love what Liesl has written about this. She has absolutely taken this issue and done gorgeous work on it.
That's very kind of you to say.
Well, it's true.
Your book is standing then as a counter to what Karen Cox wrote in a book called No Common Ground. It was about the removal of monuments, especially in the South, and how different factions, because of their feelings towards the past and towards the meaning of those monuments, there's no common ground to make decisions on. But that is not actually true in your book. Chapter by chapter, interview by interview, you found common ground with each and every individual. We talked a little bit about this earlier today. The West is still a geography of hope, if you will, right? And that's the thing that you're alluding to that I wrote about with Adam Sowards. I took a moment to unpack that phrase. I have never loved that people use it without defining it. And I got my underpants in a knot and decided to go ahead and figure out that with Adam Sowards, who was very tolerant of my obsession at that point. Turns out Wallace Stegner meant the geography of hope to mean different things over the course of his life. He says it in the 60s as someone who's advocating for wilderness, and by the time of his death, he's meaning the entire American West, which told me two things, and then Sowards helped me puzzle out a third thing. The geography of hope is an aspirational phrase about the West. It is also an evolutionary process, that one generation's geography of hope is not going to be another's, and you have to make room for that redefinition. And then the third thing we puzzled out together is that it can't be anything but relational. So that is what you're talking about with reconciliation. How do you end this book?
I end this book talking about listening and how important it is to listen to one another and listen to people in a way that's open-hearted and curious. And we're not going to agree. And I also want to say, and I've said it, there are bad guys. There are definitely bad guys, but I think that it's really important to continue to be in dialogue with each other. And it is really hard right now, especially during pandemic. We weren't talking to each other. We were isolated. We were getting information on social media about, we were getting stories about each other from manipulative people or manipulative media. And then our small town newspapers, they're disappearing. And so there's so much that's happening right now that's preventing us from being in a relationship with each other. But I talk about how communities still have the opportunity to be whole, to be resilient, to be in relationship. And I see national politics right now as being absolutely gridlocked and scary. But I do feel like there is the ability in our communities to be in dialogue. I just have heard a very wonderful story in one of the most conservative towns in one of the most conservative states in this country, Idaho, in Bonner's Ferry. There was a school board that was taken over by extremists, and they wanted to ban books and they wanted to defund public schools. I mean, they were absolutely atrocious. They appointed a supervisor who had no interest whatsoever. He was affiliated with the most extreme of the extreme. And this school board was taken over because I think the two of them won by something like 5 votes. And they thought this community was going to be complacent, and it was so conservative that they thought they would be able to just do this and get away with it. The community called for a recall, and they took back their school board, and they kicked the superintendent out, and they're like, not going to happen here. And this is in Bonner's Ferry. And that is, if anybody knows the Idaho Panhandle, that is a conservative community. And they fought them. And it was because there was a coalition of conservative Republicans, Democrats, organizers, activists, participants in something called the Idaho 97 Percenters, which is the 3 percenters is a national militia group. And so this is the Idaho 97 Percenters. And so this was a coalition that all worked together. They have very different politics. And they fought back. And it's possible if we can be in relationship with each other and start to rebuild trust.
And stories are the key to that. Not once do you tear down these myths in your book. You show what's behind them. So my closing question before we get to Q&A is, what stories then do we need to tell ourselves? What, I hesitate to say new myths, but what new myths do we need to hold on to, build and hold on to in the West to keep this community and build it more than what it even is now? I know Bozeman's a community. Boulder's a community. Fort Collins is a community. I don't deal with Boulder, by the way. I live in Fort Collins. I don't do Boulder. Not my community. Not my community, right? But maybe I should.
What are new myths? Well, that's a tricky one. In terms of stories, well, I end my book talking about the falsehood of the irreconcilable other. And so I do think that there are forces, or there are people making money that are keeping us angry at each other. And there are politicians who are staying in power because we refuse to talk to each other. We dig in. I talk so much about factionalism in this book, and I start out with biblical literalism and the fact that there are people who say, you have to just believe in every single thing. If you're going to be part of our group, you have to believe every single thing here. And so I want to say that it's okay to be nuanced. It's okay to approach people. You're not capitulating. You're not betraying your faction if you're in relationship with each other. It's okay to question things. It's okay to be nuanced. You don't have to be black and white. And I think that both, I'm not going to offer a false equivalency. I do not think both parties have moved the same way. I think one party is definitely moving a way that's very dangerous. But I do think it's okay to say, I'm going to be open-minded and listen to what you have to say and not dig in and say, I don't want to hear a single thing because I'm loyal to this particular set of beliefs. And so I think nuance is really important. And I think all of us need to think about that, because I do think it's really easy to get dug in. I got dug in. I started this book feeling really angry. I was angry about all the falsehoods that were proliferating. I was angry about Trumpism. I was really mad. And what I realized is that going into something angry, it's not helpful. It's okay to be angry. And there are things to be angry about, believe me. But I think that in conversation, there's a way to be more engaged.
So it sounds like you're saying, instead of the West as a museum of national misperception, this is a region, or at least at the regional level, we can create the West as a museum of common collection, where difference isn't a divider, but is a complement. Does that resonate? Oh, okay. I got my summative brain on here. With that, are you ready to take some questions from the audience?
Yes. How do you use that as a ability to create a space to have conversation?
That's a really good question, because you're right. I mean, it's not like you have the opportunity to sit down and have these conversations. One of the things that I loved that I saw was something called Idaho Listens that was done at Boise State, where they had people of all different political background. There was a Nez Perce woman. There was a Jewish woman who was a rape survivor. There was an LDS elder and everything in between. I mean, it was really fascinating. And everybody got up to tell their story. They had 10 minutes to tell their story. And then afterwards, everybody got to talk. And it was people from very different backgrounds that came together. And in this case, it was, who is Idaho? And I watched it. It was marvelous. It was absolutely marvelous. And I'm going to suggest that maybe MSU can borrow something like that, because I think it would be super cool. Because I think bookstores can do stuff like this. I think universities can do stuff like this. I think libraries can do stuff like this. I think that we need to intentionally create these conversations, because I think that we need to create spaces that we can interact and we can hear different people's stories. And so, yeah, I think that's an excellent question, because we don't have that opportunity. I would love to see us create that opportunity. I think it would do a lot to go towards healing and understanding. So thank you for that question. Yeah, let's do something like Montana Listens.
I understand you've been traveling around eastern Montana.
Yes.
Can you tell me how stopping American Prairie is going to save the cowboy?
Okay, that's an interesting question. I know a little bit about that. I did find those billboards and that campaign to be sort of interesting. I wonder, and I don't want to get too much into it, because I'm not sure of all the nuance. I don't think that reaction was a great reaction. I don't think it is going to save the cowboy, but it's an effective campaign, right? And I mean that by the Nature Conservancy and some of the people who put that together were effective in the way they used the cowboy myth. And so I do think that that has created pushback to the American Prairie Reserve, which my husband and I have both been supportive of, and really David was on the scientific advisory committee. So I'm afraid that what that is a reaction to that goes back decades and decades and decades, environment versus jobs, or sagebrush rebellion, or wise use. These are recycled campaign slogans, and I don't think that stopping the American Prairie Reserve is going to save the cowboy. Yeah, I'm afraid that I don't feel like I have a good answer to that. I mean, I know that it was at a historic low. I know that there were a lot of people that it had impacted. The only thing I can say is we're going to have these droughts and low levels of water. And I mean, this is something that we're going to have to come to terms with. I mean, one of the things I talk about is a very real reason to be in dialogue with each other is that we have real issues facing us over climate. And it's imperative that we can talk to each other because these are resources that we desperately all need. Now, I talked about climate change. There were people who very much believed in climate change. And then I had a lot of people who didn't believe that it was human caused. I did have one chapter where I, as I said, I had the people who I wrote about read my chapter. And I had one woman who was very upset about me talking about climate change. I went back and I didn't say this is still up in the air or anything like that. But I did change my language a little bit because I want people to read this book that have varying opinions. I make it very clear that climate change is real, but I just a little bit softened the way I had gone and said, the most difficult conversation I had, we talked about climate change and talked about it saying this was something that was very tension filled and he wasn't seeing that climate change was something that was really important for us to address. And I just softened it slightly and they were happy with it, even though I was still able to talk about it. So to answer your question, yes, we talked about climate change. I think that we talked about, we were in agreement that there had to be adjustments to agriculture. One of the things that came up was the fact that so much of the Colorado River goes to alfalfa production, and there was agreement about rethinking things, but water rights are very touchy. And I talked about water rights with the Bundys. I mean, and that's, again, one of the reasons why we better have better relationships, because we're about ready to go and have to decide really, really hard things. And if we hate each other, it's not going to be very easy. I think people got really lonely during pandemic and they found community online. And there was definitely community there. People felt empowered. And Stuart Rhodes really, really looked at people who were insecure. And Tasha said he might find somebody in a job that they weren't happy with. He might find somebody that he would empower them as more masculine. Here's your chance to carry an AR-15 and defend. And I was talking to Liesl today about this. The interesting thing about Stuart Rhodes is he wanted to be a part of Black Lives Matter, marching with Black organizers until he realized that that was unpopular with the Oath Keepers. And then all of a sudden he was on the roof preventing looters from coming in. So he was really a chameleon in terms of that, but it was creating community. Absolutely 100%. I do think that there's a lot of fear, but I also think that people who practice traditional ranching and mining, logging, some of these. I look at communities, at sawmill towns in Idaho. I look at traditional ranching communities. I look at some of the places where there were really good mining jobs. And because of economic factors, some of these people really feel left behind. And there has not been good solutions to, well, how do you create vibrant economies in some of these communities that have been hurt by jobs, traditional jobs, extractive jobs that have been impacted by economic factors. And what they blame is environmental factors. And by blaming environmental factors, they're blaming Democrats. So it's complicated. And I do think that there are people that, oh, sorry, go ahead. So I think that's a really good point. I do think that some of the reasons why rural communities are targeted by extremists is because there is a lot of anger over what you're talking about and over some of the issues that come about because of differing sort of changing economic opportunities. Yeah, one more question. Oh, Francine.
So a couple things. Thank you for doing the Indigenous Peoples and Land Acknowledgement. And I'd also like to add, I'm an oral historian and I concentrate a lot on bison and bison removal from the land. And so also thanking other species, keystone species that were removed for the benefit of the settlement of the land. And then the other thing that I wanted to ask about was just the title of True West and how, I guess, Betsy, how you came to that title. You know, when I first read it, I was like, oh, I kind of don't like the title because, like, what is truth? And who gets to determine what is true and not true? And being also having a background in Native American studies, and of course, growing up, I learned about history from a very Eurocentric lens until I did a master's degree in Native American studies. And so the word true is whose truth? And there can be multiple truths at one time. And so I just wanted to know how you came to that.
By the way, Francine was unbelievably helpful in writing this book, and she was so incredibly generous in sharing her truth, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate her. True West came about, it's a title of a play by Sam Shepard, so I used that because I thought that it's meant to be a little bit ironic just based on what you talked about, because what I do talk about is so many different truths, and I feel like because it does cover mythology, and I really do get to the fact that we live in a mythological place, and I also, I mean, I talk quite a bit about the fact that we have so many Eurocentric ways of seeing things that are mythological, and really try to talk about Indigenous ways of seeing as well, which is, again, something that's so important for us to acknowledge in terms of understanding the West. So it's meant to be a little bit ironic, and your point was kind of what I was trying to get at. So thank you so much for that question. And again, thank you so much for the help that you provided in this book. It was really incredible.
You have just heard a recording made on the evening of November 1st, 2023, in the Hager Auditorium of the Museum of the Rockies, when the Ivan Doig Center for the Study of the Lands and Peoples of the North American West hosted a conversation between historians Betsy Gaines Quammen and Liesl Carr Childers, addressing issues raised in Dr. Quammen's second book, True West, Myth and Mending on the Far Side of America. Her earlier book is American Zion, Cliven Bundy, God and Public Lands in the West. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on listener-supported Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman. And you can support this listener-supported community radio station by going to kgvm.org and click on the support button at the top of the page, where you can also find our interview with Betsy Gaines Quammen about her earlier book, American Zion, Cliven Bundy, God and Public Lands in the West. We thank you for listening and for your support.